Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Okay, so we're in Genesis 35. We just had in Genesis 34... Dinah gets assaulted, and then the brothers of Joseph, they go and they trick the people, and then they end up killing them. So Genesis 35 will continue. Genesis 35 starts like this. God said to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there. Make there an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you, and purify yourselves, and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, that I may make there an altar to God, who answers me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I go." So they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, and the rings that were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree near Shechem. I think it's interesting that they just casually just, we've just got a bunch of idols in our house, and they know, like, we're not supposed to have these things, but we'll just have them along. Jacob says, okay, it's time to put those away. It's time to go to church. So, you know, Sunday morning, put your Baal statues and your Molech statues away. It's time to go to church. And then presumably later on, you take them back out again. But Sunday's a day for God. The rest of the week is dedicated to these foreign gods. It's just, all right. It's interesting, I'll say. Verse 5, and they journeyed, and as they journeyed, a terror from God fell upon the cities that were around them, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And there he built an altar, and he called the place El Bethel, because God was there and revealed it to him, and he fled from his brothers. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried under the oak below Bethel. So he called its name Alon Bakuth. Let me look what these things are called real quick. Verse 5. It's not good. Okay. El Bethel means God of Bethel. Bethel means house of God, so God of the house of God. Okay. And then Alon Bakuth means oak of weeping. Oh, that's sweet. Verse 9, God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram. He blessed him, and God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. No longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. So you shall be named Israel." And God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and the kings shall come from your body. The land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your offspring after you." Then God went up from him to the place where he had spoken with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in its place, and we had spoken with him, a pillar of stone. He poured out a drink offering on it and poured oil on it. So Jacob called the name of the place where God had spoken to him Bethel. Well, he's really creative with these names. Bethel, 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 Bethel. So all these, Bethel, again, meaning house of God. Jacob's name goes back and forth when it's talking about Jacob. When Jacob wrestles with God, this is when you first hear that Jacob is going to be called Israel, which means struggles with God. And then it's reiterated again here. Jesus does a similar thing when he gives people new names. When he calls Peter, he says, "You'll be called Peter. You'll not be called Simon. You'll be called Peter." But I think he's still referenced later on as Simon. So sometimes the names can get a little tricky. People have multiple names, but just for the sake of following along, Jacob is Israel. Israel is Jacob, and then going on further, it's going to start referring to him more and more as Israel. All right, verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel. When they were still some distance from Ephrath, Rachel went into labor when she had hard labor. And when her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you have another son." And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died, and she was buried. She was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Oh, interesting. So if you're curious, again, this is another one of those places that has multiple names. So she's on her name to Bethlehem when she gives birth to Benjamin. And Jacob set up a pillar over the tomb. It is a pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. So it's interesting, it calls him Jacob and it calls him Israel, kind of back to back. Ben-Oni could mean son of my sorrow or son of my strength. Benjamin means son of the right hand. And a lot of times the right hand is a term that means the strength. So God shows his right hand or bears his right hand or protects me with his right hand. A lot of times that means the strength. Verse 22, when Israel lived in that land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. So the family's still doing what the family does. And Israel heard of it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's servant, Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's servant, Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. It might be helpful to draw a diagram to keep track of who all these people are and who they come from. And Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last, and he died, and he was gathered to his people, old and full of days, and his son Esau and Jacob buried him. All right. So that's the end of Isaac. That's the end of Rachel. And now it's their descendants. These are the generations of Esau, that is Edom. So again, keep in mind that Esau is sometimes called Edom. Later on, you'll hear about the Edomites. Those are the descendants of Esau. So when they come up later and they're picking fights with the Israelites, just connected all the way back to Jacob and Esau. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Oh boy. Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibion the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Nebaioth, and Adah bore to Esau Eliphaz. Basemath bore Reuel, and Oholibamah bore Jesu, Jalem, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his livestock, and all of his beasts, and all of his property, and all that he acquired in the land of Canaan. He went away. He went into a land away from his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau settled up in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. This is, again, reiterating, Esau is Edom. Pay attention to this when we start talking about the Edomites later. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites of the hill country of Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Adah, the wife of Esau. Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's brother. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Reuel, Nathan, Zerah, Shammah, and Mizah. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibion, Esau's wife. She bore to Esau Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. This keeps going for a while. I'm going to go through it all. The takeaway is if you hear a name that really, that you're like, hey, that name sounds familiar, I heard about it elsewhere, that might be important. One of the other takeaways here is that this is just another example of, look, this is a historical book. This is talking about genealogies. This is not talking about a fictional fable. This is not saying the sons of Zeus were Hercules, or Heracles actually was a half son of Zeus. Well, I mean, it was a full son of Zeus, and it's not talking about, and then each of them have their own fancy story. It's like, these are all of their kids. Only some of them ever show up in the Bible later on. But just for the sake of tracking genealogy, because this is a real person, a real thing that happened, and a real timeline, these are the descendants. So you hear sometimes that Genesis is poetry. There is poetry in Genesis, but Genesis also is largely a recording of historical fact. Now, yeah, there is some poetic language in Genesis, but again, the fact that we have so many genealogies in it kind of indicates that this is actually supposed to be taken as historical reality. All right, well, let's keep going. I'm going to butcher the rest of these names. Verse 15, these are the chiefs, the sons of Esau, the son of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, the chief Teman, Omar, Zepho, Kenaz, Korah, Gatam, and Amalek. These are the chiefs of Eliphaz, the land of Edom. These are the sons of Adah. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's sons, the chiefs of Nahath, Zerah, Shema, and Mizah. These are the chiefs of Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Oholibamah, Esau's wife, the chiefs Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. These are the chiefs born to Oholibamah. I was getting this one. Oholibamah, the daughter of Anoz, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Esau, that is Edom, in case you forgot that Esau was Edom. And these are their chiefs. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite, the inhabitants of the land, Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anna, Dishon, Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Hemam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. These are the sons of Shobal, Alvan, Manahath, Ebal, Shepho, and Onam. These are the sons of Zibeon, Aya, and Anna. He is Anna, who was found in the hot springs in the wilderness as he pastured the donkeys of Zibeon, his father. These are the children of Anna, the Dishon, and Oholibamah's daughter of Anna. These are the sons of Dishon, Hemdan. Well, this keeps going for a while, huh? Eshban, Ithran, and Cheran. These are the sons of Ezer, Bilhan, Zavan, and Akan. These are the sons of Dishon, Uz, and Aran. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the chiefs, Lotan's, Shobal, Zibeon, Anna, Dishon, Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the chief by chief in the land of Seir. Can you imagine reading this? How come this chapter didn't make it into the little kids' Bible stories? I want the Archbooks version of this, where it's just listing all of these. These are the kings. I imagine somebody has taken this, somebody who just really loves history, and has drawn a really great diagram as a result of this, but for me, I'm swimming in this. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, the name of his city being Dinabah. Bela died, and Joab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. Joab died, and Husham, the land of the Temanites, reigned in his place. Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who defeated Midian in the country of Moab, reigned in his place, the name of the city being Avith. Hadad died, and Samla of the Masrekah reigned in his place. Samla died, and Shaul of Rehoboth in the Euphrates reigned in his place. Sheol died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Ekbor, reigned in his place. Baal-Hanan, the son of Ekbor, died. Hadar raised in his place, the name of the city being Pau. His wife's name was Mehetbal, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezhab. These are the names of the chiefs of Esau according to their clans and their dwelling places by their chiefs. Timnah, Alva, Jeheth, Oholibamah, Elah, Pinon, Kenaz, Timon, Mibzar, Magdiel, and Iram. These are the chiefs of Edom, that is Esau, the father of Edom, in case you forgot, according to their dwelling places in the land of their possessions. Okay. We didn't skip that chapter. Hooray. Yes, sir.
I just got one name I'd never associated with the Edomites.
Yep.
Midianites.
The Midianites. Yeah, Midian. I wonder if that's
Moses' father-in-law, right?
Yeah, I wonder if that's Yeah, that's not, I think so. Well, yes, I think that sounds right. I'm seeing, I'm trying to see if there's any notes here that talk about specifically these names, any of these names.
I'd have to double check the
So this note says, though we may not understand why God caused the names of some 200 Edomite noblemen and noblewomen to be written in his word, it's divided into 10 generations, 10 genealogies. Let me see. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of commentary on this. So I wouldn't memorize all the names, although I'm sure you could try if you'd like to. I'm sure it'd impress somebody. You say, I've got all Genesis 36 memorized and every single name. Okay, good. Genesis chapter 37, let's keep going. Joseph's dreams. Okay, now we're back to the arch book. Now we're back to the cartoon stories that I'm used to, the ones that you actually show up in the kids' Bibles that I read to them. I don't know why they left 36 out. I think that would be a fascinating chapter for kids. 37. Jacob lived in the, okay, so remember, Jacob is Israel, and you remember the deal with his kids so far. And this is gonna talk about Joseph. You know the thing about Joseph's brothers. Jacob lived in the land of his father, sojourning in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was...
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all of his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Okay, let me see what the note is for this, because I have input here. Z, it says. Septuagint. Septuagint, or Vulgate, or Syriax, is a robe with long sleeves, meaning the Hebrews are certain. Okay, so this is one of the fun things, and I probably told you this neat fact before, but maybe I haven't. You think of Joseph in his technicolor dream coat, right? That's what it's talking about here. You immediately think of Joseph's coat was his coat of many colors. The Hebrew word that's used to describe the coat is not a word that refers to colors at all. In fact, it's a word, what's it called? A hapax legomena? You know, right? Hapax legomena, does that sound right? It sounds right. It's a word that appears basically only here, and it's only used in this context. So how do we know what this word means? It's only used to refer to this coat. And breaking down the word to refer to his coat, looking at the different languages in the Latin Vulgate or the Septuagint, it looks like the word might have something to do with palm, like the palm of your hand. Well, okay, what does that mean? It's a palm coat. And some theories suggest that it is a coat, it's a robe that's long enough that it goes down to the palm of the hand. So think of like a short sleeve shirt or a long sleeve shirt. So a palm length coat, perhaps. Some people also speculate that it is, a palm is the width, it was a striped coat of different colors, and each stripe was the width of a palm, and that was the reference to the coat. Again, could be, you can come up with your own speculations. The real point is that this was a spectacular and unique coat. It was expensive. It was extravagant in some way that we don't understand, but it's just interesting that we don't know exactly what it looked like. Could it have been a rainbow? Absolutely. Could it have just been a palm length coat? Maybe it was all purple? Sure, why not? Suffice it to say, it was a very valuable coat. Now, this is our first introduction to kind of Joseph's interactions with his brothers. So Joseph, being 17, and as everybody knows, 17-year-olds are the wisest among us. They always make the right choices, especially socially, and they always get along perfectly with their siblings. This is what 17-year-olds are known for. So Joseph, our first introduction to him is him tattling on his brothers. keep in mind, these are the brothers who just murdered an entire village, and Joseph's like, Dad, they weren't watching the flocks right. Now, granted, sure, he's taking care of the flocks, but it says and he made him a robe of, okay. These are generous. Joseph, being 17-year-old, was pasturing his, so he's in the pasture with his brothers, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. So what were they doing? Who knows? Maybe they were slacking off. Maybe they were drinking on the job. It doesn't say. Point being, Joseph was the one to say, Daddy, your other sons were misbehaving. The older boys were misbehaving. And Israel being, you know, being so wise, says, oh, you're my favorite son. And just so everybody knows that you're my favorite son, here I'm going to make this wonderful coat for you so you can wear it and all your brothers can be. So not only is he a tattletale, but he's also being publicly recognized as better than all of you. That's that amongst his brothers. So it says they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Okay, makes sense. I kind of think about it like Jacob and Esau, where Jacob kind of is obnoxious and tricky and stuff like that. And God ends up using him for good, but he does do a lot of things that would get under some people's skin. Yes, sir.
Well, is it possible that the term favorable son could mean that he simply wasn't suspicious of him as he was, as Jacob was, of the other sons? Relative favor, not a...
Oh, well, no. So in verse 3, it says, now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was a son of his old age. So it wasn't so much that that he was better behaved, but it's just this, like, some people might prefer their firstborn son because they're the firstborn. In this case, this is the son of my old age. You know, this is, you know, the final thing I'm able to accomplish in this world, and it's the best thing of all. And then, of course, Benjamin comes around later. But yes, sir.
A couple things. Another thing leading into him being a favorite son is that it was his favorite wife that he came from.
That too. So who are the two? Who are the two children of Rachel? Remember, Rachel is the favored wife. Who are the two children? Joseph and Benjamin. And both of those both play an important role later on. Benjamin even plays an important role in this story later on, although Joseph steals the spotlight for most of it. All right, so this is our introduction to Joseph. He's tattling on his brothers. He's already getting on their nerves. Dad likes him more than everybody else. This is a bunch of murderers that he's picking a fight with. So this is surely going to go in his favor. Verse 5. Yes, sir.
Would Joseph be an heir of
like an inheritance?
Yeah. Would he be
probably no. Probably not. That would probably be the firstborn. I don't remember if that's Reuben or who that would be. So in that case, yeah, it wouldn't be. Yeah, in terms of the firstborn inheritance, he wouldn't have that. Although, what's stopping Jacob, Israel, from doing, you know, because Jacob got the inheritance even though he wasn't the firstborn. There could be some sort of way that would happen, but at least that much so far is not one of the reasons they don't like him. All right, verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around, and it bowed down to my sheaf. His brothers said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So not only does God send him these dreams, he doesn't just go to his father and say, God sent me this dream. He says, you know what? Not only does Dad like me more, but God likes me more. He gave me a dream where you're all bowing down to me. I'll tell you this dream. Behold, these sheaves, and you're all those sheaves, and behold, me, the sheaf, and behold, you bow down. And they're like, they're grinding their teeth at this guy. It's such a family dynamic. It's so great. So this is building up. So I don't want to say Joseph had it coming for what happens to him next, but it is understandable that he's taunting murderers and tattling on them. And doing everything he can to make them mad. And so far it said like three times that they hated him even more so. Verse 9, then he dreamed another dream, and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come and bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. So his father is thinking maybe this is actually a vision from God, and he keeps it in mind, and his brothers just add this to the list of reasons we hate Joseph. All right, verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now and see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flocks." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came, so they're like, "Oh, great. Look who it is. Look who came." Oh. They saw him from afar. Before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They're like, "Oh, great. Yeah, why don't we just kill him? That's not a bad idea. We've got 11 other sons. It's, so they saw him from afar. They conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer." So that's like his nickname now. "Oh, the dreamer's got another dream to tell us. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what has become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to him, "Shed no blood. Throw him into the pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to their father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and they threw him into the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. So they're not trying to drown him. They're just trying to put him in a place that he can't get out of. Now, pay attention specifically. Reuben's plan is actually, he says to throw him in the pit specifically because Reuben intends to save him later. Reuben's not saying throw him in the pit and let wild animals do whatever they're going to do. But Reuben specifically intends to protect his brother. So although they are a bunch of murderers already, and this is par for the course for them, Reuben decides to, well, it says he saves them from their hands. He saves them out of their hands. And that's language that's used elsewhere in Scripture, delivering people from, God delivers you from the hands of the parasites or something like that. All right, so Joseph's in the pit, verse 25. Then they sat down to eat. I imagine that he's just in the pit right next to him. "Let me out, you guys. This isn't funny anymore. Shut up. Let's eat." And they have a picnic. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites. So these would be the Arabs later on, Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let not our hands be upon him, for he is our brother and our own flesh." Okay, so now this guy's got a conscience, sure. And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. Let me see real quick. A shekel was worth about 11 grams. I'm going to see if this is a specific amount that's mentioned later because, okay. The notes here say Midianites were desert-dwelling descendants of Abraham through his wife. The relation here with the Ishmaelites is unclear. Perhaps the Midianites and Ishmaelites were intermingled, or that they were both a Midianite and an Ishmaelite traders in the group. Two terms are used interchangeably, 20 shekels of silver, the typical price for a male slave during this era, attesting to the earlier second millennium context of the story. The price for slaves went up over time and was demonstrated in Scripture. And then later on it'll talk about an important instance of 30 pieces of silver, which will come into play later on in the New Testament. That's the fee that Judas gets. So 20 pieces of silver is the fee for a slave right now. So what they did is they took him and Judas said, "Let's sell him to slavery." I don't know if the goal was let's get some money out of it, or he was really having pangs of conscience of, well, let's not kill him after all. Even though they decided to put him in the pit, I don't know, I assume if they just left him there, then he would die anyway. All right. Verse 29. Okay, so remember, Reuben had gone off and he was going to come back and he was going to free Joseph out of the pit. So he wasn't there when they were eating lunch and when they decided to sell him into slavery. So when Reuben returned and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to the father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it, and they said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son for many days. All his sons and his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. All right, one of the things that you'll see multiple times throughout Scripture is this concept of tearing robes, sackcloth, and ashes. Sometimes there's no ashes mentioned here, but later on it'll talk about people sitting in a pile of ashes or putting ashes on their head. This is kind of an outward expression of mourning and grief. So imagine for a while in American tradition, we would have people would wear black, maybe even a black veil or something like that. The idea was that it's like fasting. It's depriving yourself of bright colors. It's recognizing your grief. Sackcloth is presumably scratchy and uncomfortable to wear. Likewise, ashes are disgusting and they get everywhere and it's hard to wash them off. So these people, they can't comfort him. And he says he will go down to Sheol, down to the pit, down to the land of the dead, where the dead reside. So he will be mourning until he dies, is what he says. So he's not going to stop grieving. Let's see, what else is there? What was that? Yeah, they ripped their clothes. Well, so they didn't, traditionally the grieving is ripping the clothes. It's either grieving or great distress. So Jesus says something at one point. I remember what Jesus says. He says, basically claims to be God, and one of the high priests rips his clothes in response to that. And presumably these are expensive clothes too. But yes, it's either great distress, is tearing of the garments, rending of the garments you see sometimes, or it's great sadness. Torn clothes, sackcloth, and ashes, these sorts of things. Let's see if there's anything else specifically here. Took his robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the goat's blood. I'm not sure if I want to lean too heavily into that as like a sacrificial type thing. I don't really see too much connection there. All right, I'll keep going. All right, chapter 38. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to his... this story. So in the... the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife and stuff like that. That's the next one that comes in the kids' storybook. You don't get the story of Judah and Tamar. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and he called his name Onan. Yet again, she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Judah was in Chezib when she bore him. So, okay, yeah. This is going to turn into a really weird family story. Hey, good to see you guys. I was planning on coming out and visiting you if I didn't see you today. Wonderful to see you. All right, and Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of the brother-in-law to her and raise up an offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that his offspring would not be his, so whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste his seed on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. The Lord put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow for your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brother." So Tamar went and remained in his father's house. This is a weird, again, it just gets weirder with Tamar and everything else like this. To explain the situation going on here, This guy's name, E-R. Ur and Tamar are supposed to be married. In the Israelite tradition, basically what you're supposed to do is if you've got a husband and wife and the husband dies and the wife is now a widow, you're supposed to, presumably she loses all the inheritance because she doesn't have any, if she doesn't have any offspring. So it was the duty of the brother to marry that wife and then to give her offspring. So that she doesn't remain without somebody to carry on the lineage, to carry on the name. And this is the sin. This is the sin that's described here. Now, people will, Roman Catholics often point to this verse in particular and talk about this as the sin of contraception. This is why, and there's arguments against contraception that I would make, but I wouldn't use this verse for that. The real sin here is, that Onan's job, go to your brother's wife and perform the duty of the brother-in-law to her, raise up offspring for your brother. Not just knock her up, but go and be a father to the children and continue the generation. And that was Onan's job. Now Onan went over to the woman and he took advantage of her, but he never allowed her to be pregnant. He never allowed her to have offspring, which was his entire job. So God kills him as well because, one, he's taking advantage of a woman. Two, he's got a specific job that he's supposed to do. And not only does he doesn't just say, no, I'll have nothing to do with this woman, but he decides to act on his own benefit, but then act against her benefit. So because of that, just like God killed God also kills Onan for being wicked. This story usually doesn't make it into the kids' books so much, but it does come up now and then. If it ever does come up, pay attention to exactly what was done wrong, what the promise was that was broken in order that the person was killed. All right, then Judah said to Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house, etc., until Shelah, the youngest son, grows up. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went to Timnah, to his sheep shearers, he and his friend, here are the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil. Wrapping herself, she sat in the entrance of Eniam, which was on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. So she's waiting for this youngest son to grow up to be given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Oh, grief. So what are you going to do, Judah? This is your daughter-in-law. He turned to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come into you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He said, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge until you send it, he said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet, so the ring, and your cord and the staff that is in your hand. So he gave this to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. So again, this family does not cease to plumb the depths of depravity with their relations with one another. And yet, this is still the lineage that God chooses to work with. Verse 20, when Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge to the woman's hand, he did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, where is the colt prostitute who was at Eniam by the roadside? And they said, no colt prostitute has been there. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. Also the men of the place say, no colt prostitute has been there. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat and you did not find her. So he calls her specifically a cult prostitute because prostitution was often considered a religious ritual back then. You would have female priestesses in the other religions around Christianity, around Yahwehism, around Judaism, whatever you want to call it. Every other religion did actually have female priests, but their job was to be a temple prostitute. So temple prostitutes, cult prostitutes were a regular thing. This was part of the worship, that was part of the income, that was part of the way that you could trick people to going into the temples. All right, verse 24, I'm going to just finish this chapter. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. A little bit of a hypocrite there, huh? Don't you think? And she was being brought out. She sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are. And the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah identified them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. So he was supposed to marry his youngest son to her, and he didn't do that. Didn't give her the right to trick him and do what she did, but still, he was unrighteous to her multiple ways. Verse 27, when the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb, and when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But as he drew his hand back in, behold, his brother came out, and he said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore his name was called Perez. And after his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, his name was Zerah. So then we get back to the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife and all this other stuff. Again, you'll see why this story of Tamar is kind of skipped in the kids' Bible. It's that family doing what that family does best, coming up with weird and bizarre ways to sin. But again, this is a reminder that God uses sinful people to carry out his plan. And it's through these generations of people who, in spite of all the things they do wrong, God still remains faithful, even though they remain faithless. So are there any questions or comments before we close? All right, let's close with the doxology.